I'd like to welcome you all to Pollution and Solutions. And for me, this is a particular interest. I am from Boulder, Colorado, and those of you who are familiar with the West, you probably know what a beautiful, crisp, clean, great city that is. It's fantastic. And for me personally, I have a strong interest in what we are here to discuss today. My name is Kevin Cork. I'll be your moderator, but primarily I'm here to sort of be a ringleader, sort of herd the cats, if you will. We have some outstanding, brilliant people here who'd like to share some thoughts with you today about some of the fantastic solutions that are ongoing. Now, obviously, as a journalist, I've heard the criticism on many occasions that you simply talk about the bad. You never talk about the good things that are going on. And one of the reasons that this is so important is success does breed success. And I think when people hear encouraging news, I think it gives them something else to draw from and perhaps might even spark a greater interest in what is happening in the world. I'd like to introduce our panelists, but instead of doing it the old traditional way and say, this is Bob Jones and this is Steve Smith and this is Callie Kay, I'm going to let them tell you just a bit about themselves and dive right in. I want to maximize the amount of time we have for questions. There are just a few ground rules today. They're very, very simple. If you ask a question, please identify yourself, ask your question. I'll then repeat your question for clarity, and then we'll let the panel have at it. Gentlemen, the only rule I have for you is have fun today, because this is your opportunity to stand on a great stage and share your thoughts and spar and joust just a bit. I promise not to go easy on any of you. So if you would start us off, Yalmaz, go right ahead.
Sure, just to introduce myself.
Yes.
Okay, so hello everyone. My name is Yalmaz Siddiqui. I am Senior Director of Environmental Strategy for Office Depot, and my role in the company is to champion environmental sustainability and encourage everyone in every functional area, whether it's merchandising or marketing or purchasing or supply chain, to take on sustainability as part of their own role.
Morning, everyone. My name is Eric Winke. I'm the AVP of Corporate Development at Baptist Health South Florida. Like you must, my role, all sustainability initiatives through Baptist Health roll up into my area. Specifically, I'm focused on creating green cultural change both at Baptist Health and throughout healthcare in general. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is John Turchin. I'm a developer originally from South Florida here. My grandfather moved here in 1920s, and we've been responsible for building a large part of Miami. But my recent project, I've been living in the mountains in North Carolina for the last 10 years, and I've taken a mountain and basically trying to make it completely self-sufficient. And I've done it on some islands in the past, but my what I'm really working on right now is solar energy, where we're taking the future, and I see it so easy if everybody would just understand how easy it is to really do it.
Brilliantly said. One of the things that is of particular interest for me personally is sustainability. We hear a great deal about how our resources are being depleted, and they are, but I think it's remarkable what people can do when pressed to do more with less and to create new opportunities. Yalmaz, I'd like to begin by letting you sort of branch out, do your presentation if you would, and then we'd love to dive into questions if that would be okay with you. Your left collar is just a bit up. Left? No, that would be your right. There you go.
Not only an MC, but a fashion advisor, too. That'd be good.
You look splendid. Go right ahead, please.
Thank you so very much. Okay, thanks, Kevin. And so today I'm going to do a slightly different thing than the panel description describes, which is I'm not necessarily going to go deep into the untold success stories of Office Depot, but I will try. I'll mention some, but my main premise is that I'd like to make some recommendations to you as writers. If you're all writers, are you all writers?
Most.
Okay, great. So I would recommend that you, given the power you have with your pen or your keyboard, help rebrand environmentalism by accepting incrementalism, using incrementalism to cycle positive action upwards. I would like you to recognize the psychology of behavior change and recognize, when I say that, that people and companies and governments change when they want to, and there are certain things that help them change faster and certain things that encourage them to change slower. And recognizing the psychology of human behavior change might help you achieve your goals if you're trying to drive environmental change in this country. And relatedly, pulling positively rather than pushing negatively and normalizing the idea of greening can help you and help internal champions like me drive the greening of our companies and drive the greening of America. Has anyone read this book? So this is one of my fourth recommendation is to read this book. I'll give you one very short example of a story in this book about behavior change, environmental behavior change. So psychologists who wrote this book did a study where they put their little cards in guest rooms, hotel rooms, please reuse your towel cards. Who's seen those cards? Everyone's seen those cards. Who listens to those cards? You're all environmental journalists, that's why. the experiment was this. The three messages were help save the planet and water and reuse your towel. Join other men and women and reuse your towel. 67% and there's three different messages. 67% of men and women in these rooms, in this hotel, reuse their towels. So which message worked?
67.
The third message. The non eco-guilt message, the it is normal to do these things message, worked three times as effectively as the save the planet message. So that's the headline, normalization may be the most powerful nudge, is, I hope, something you take away from the presentation. This is a little bit about our sort of self-congratulatory, there is a self-congratulatory opportunity in this panel, and Office Depot just got number 8 in the Newsweek Green Rankings, and we got that with a headquarters in Florida. Now, Florida is not Seattle, and so we've had to work a lot internally to drive the culture change in our company without the benefit of a social context and a geographic context that is supportive. So the lessons I hope to impart are from the experience I've had 8 years or so 7 years at Office Depot trying to drive behavior change where this stuff is not necessarily normal or part of the culture here. And so I'm gonna illustrate my thinking through first a thought experiment, and please answer this question. B, who said B? Excellent, you are correct. Which of these is correct?
All.
They're all green. So historically in America, we've had this perception, and coming from Europe, you definitely see that there's sort of broader acceptance of greenness. In America, there's a, just like in other parts of the cultural makeup here, there is an absolute divide in this country where the environmental community, environmental thinking is perceived as this, right? And therefore, anyone who's maybe got a slight inclination to maybe do green things is less likely to do green things because they think, I'm now joining that camp. I'm not that camp. I don't want to join that camp. So my next message is supporting incrementalism and allowing people to jump onto this journey a little bit is a very powerful way to enable the journey and to help people individually say, yeah, I can be light green. I can do one thing or two things. I don't need to transition my life or my company in order to get into this space. At Office Depot, we've started to do this. We've done some work to define greener products, and so our message is there's non-green in our yellow, light green in our light green, mid green and dark green. So we're trying to help companies understand, buyers of ours understand that it's okay to buy light green products that might be perceived as greenwashed by some people who have this binary mentality, but it's okay to buy 10% recycled product because it's better than 0% recycled product. You don't need to go to 100. So as a message to you, we, as corporate champions, are trying to pull our organizations, and we've learned that dark green approaches, pure green approaches, don't work. They won't enable the journey. They won't help us pull all functional areas in a greener way. So my question to you, and hopefully this will trigger some stories, what could enable the journey, and how could you help leverage the psychology of behavior change in your environmental writing? The common approach is doom and gloom. Remains the most common approach. Doom and gloom, deforestation, sea level rise, toxic waste, bad, bad, bad. The common behavior change strategy, particularly for corporate and business, is guilt. You are bad. Has anyone read Ecology of Commerce? Yes. First five chapters, you want to slit your wrists because everything's down. And business is bad. Business is terrible. That's it.
Yeah, boss.
Yeah.
That's my boss right there.
Is it? Okay. I tried to get YouTube video. This is the Audi Green Police video. It's an ad, Super Bowl ad. I'd highly recommend looking at this.
It's
just do a Google search for Audi Green Police. And it shows, basically, when someone's doing something environmentally bad, the green police arrive and arrest them. Okay, and so it's a very funny ad that I think in some ways illustrates this old approach of you know, you're bad and be guilty because you've done something wrong. And so my message from the standpoint of an organizational change maker in corporate America is that I've been most effective in driving behavior change, and you could be more effective, I'd argue, in driving organizational behavior change by recognizing the WIFM and the WIFMO. Does anyone take a guess at what those are? You're good. What's in it for me? What's in it for my organization? And they might be different, but there is an overlap. So if you can find a writing that speaks to the heart of someone who's in decision-making capacity in corporate America, and appeals to their personal interests and helps appeal to their organizational interests, that's when you're going to find ability to change. Much environmental writing speaks to the fact that going green is expensive and reinforces that what I would argue is a misperception about green, because the misperception focuses on this end of the green savings continuum, the higher initial cost end. But the truth is, there is a whole spectrum of green choices that people and companies can make that save money, and focusing on those will much more powerfully engage companies and governments, because it's a whiffer. I'm going to save money. There is a what's in it for me. Lower initial cost products or solutions. Higher initial cost but lower operating costs over time. So 1 year payback, 2 year payback, 3 year payback for lighting or technology or whatever. Higher initial cost, lower repurchase cost. Here's an example. This is a reusable thing. It costs $10 versus a 20-cent paper cup. It's cheap. The 20-cent paper cup is cheap, but not cheap after I've spent $10 on paper cup. So let's bring that argument out. Price parity as well.
1 minute.
Yeah. Okay. Could you write more savings? Could you write more stories about cost savings? Quality and design. Often the aesthetic of green is crunchy and ugly. In thinking about the pictures you use, the images you use in your magazines, making them crisper, more modern, more normal would be helpful. Method's done that very well. So could you write more stories about the product quality of, the green products becoming better quality and develop a new aesthetic in your journalism? Let's go. So normalization. Lead is really growing gangbusters. I have not seen a huge number of stories on the growth of lead. The fact is, the forecasts show by 2020 there is going to be 50 Manhattans worth of LEED for existing buildings, LEED certified buildings under LEED EB. Mm-hmm. 50 Manhattans worth. That's a complete transition of the way people operate their buildings. They're going to buy greener paper, greener technology, greener furniture. But this is from October 12th. New York Times, Eco Meets the Economy. The message is eco-consumers are not buying greener anymore. And he can no longer afford green products, so he started cleaning his home with a solution he whips up. That solution he whips up himself is greener.
It's greener, that's right.
It's greener. Mm-hmm. But the message is totally negatively framed. and reinforces for the marketplace that this stuff is not normal and it's expensive and it's bad and I'm not going to do it. So I would argue we can flip that by not isolating and pulling out stories that show lack of growth, but find the growth and there is a lot of it. So these sorts of things. There was a lot of them in 2008, 2009. There's still a lot of stories out there that could be told, and I would argue that you would be more effective if you sold them. Here's some examples that we're doing in Office Depot. We've started developing a nutrition label with the shade of green idea on our products. We've had a green book for the last 8 years. We're helping bring greener products to customers with a much more modern and fresh aesthetic. We're starting to deliver products in paper bags instead of cardboard boxes with an 80% reduction in material footprint. So could you write more stories on environmental innovations that drive business value without, and this is an important point, without the but that negates? And that but is, but they could do more, but they're not doing this. The but negates and stops celebrating the first things you wrote about. Sorry? You're journalists? Is that what you're saying?
You won't be balanced.
You won't be able to balance, maybe. But I think the point I'm trying to make is, do you want to affect change? Is what is the goal is the question.
Well, journalists
want
to be balanced, though.
Yeah.
But it's your job to present the reality.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I didn't get your name.
I'm Kellen.
And Kellen was saying that it's not balanced if... And I think this is probably a good point to just sort of open this up to comments and questions. The real challenge as a journalist is your editor will say to you, that's a great piece about a wonderful thing. What's the other side? What's the other side of the story?
Okay.
And so
I would argue back, it depends on the scale you're looking at. I would say at the macro level, most stories about corporate environmental efforts are negative. Most stories are negatively framed. And so by adding more positive, partly you're balancing at the macro level, maybe not in your story itself, but another nuance I'd add is in your story, you might be able to add a but do so in a way that speaks to opportunity rather than problem, right? So the company's doing this, it's not that they're not doing that, but there might be even more opportunity for them to succeed and benefit if they also did this, and that's the point I'm trying to make. So last,
and I think also,
Laurie, your name?
Yeah, Laurie William.
Maybe, yeah. But yeah. Have you read this book? Anyone read this book? This is How to Change When Change is Hard. And one of the key messages these guys write about change is finding the bright spots is by far more powerful in terms of driving change and achieving solution than focusing on the 80 or 90% of things that are going bad. The solutions are found when you look for the good and understand the good and the drivers of the good and the results of the good.
Gentlemen, okay. Very nicely done. Thank you for that. That was beautifully done. Let's get Eric Winkie in here really quickly. Eric?
Sure. Be happy to. And thank you for... handling the slides.
You're welcome.
So, morning, everyone. Thank you for coming out to today's discussion. I'll be focusing on creating green cultural change, sharing success stories, and specifically on healthcare environments. For now, I'll just give a brief overview, introduction, and leave most of the time open to explore in Q&A. As mentioned, my name is Eric Wenke. I'm the AVP of Corporate Development at Baptist Health South Florida. I've just put my contact information up if anybody wants to reach out later. I'll keep moving quick. So for those not familiar, Baptist Health South Florida is a large not-for-profit healthcare organization, outstanding reputation for medical and service excellence. We're comprised of 6 hospitals, about 24 outpatient centers, international divisions, physician practice groups, et cetera, around $2.5 billion in revenue. We're the largest private employer in South Florida, about 15,000 employees strong and growing. We rank towards the top systems in the country for patient and physician satisfaction. Fortune ranked number 32, top 100 best places to work, and a couple of years ago we started to think about our sustainability initiatives and why green healthcare and what that can mean for us. One reason this is important is that hospital operations consume large amounts of resources and energy and thus present great opportunities for savings. For those who can't see the chart online, it's a representation of BTUs per square foot, so energy usage per square foot, and healthcare ranks way over to the right. That has to do with our 24/7 operations, regulatory requirements, multiple redundancies, et cetera. There's a lot of reasons why that's the case, but it also opens the door for opportunities, if you could. So I thought a number of important points were brought up earlier. I'd like to actually reinforce those because it essentially mirrors a lot of our thinking. In organizing our green initiatives, it was our belief that many green programs stall because organizations reach for large initiatives before they're culturally ready. So you hear a lot of companies talking about, and we talked about solar panels or wind initiatives or multi-million-dollar initiatives, and they wind up talking about it for 3-5 years and still assessing whether it can be right for them. A point was brought up about normalization, organizational change, and how to encourage that. We actually created what we call the green adoption curve, and we started to measure. We have 15,000 employees. How did the 15,000 feel? So this is not necessarily how did Eric feel, how did the CEO feel, how did any one party feel, but how does, as an organization, everybody feel about what we're doing? We felt that at the beginning, if we were very early on in our path, people would be saying, what is green and why is that important for here? As we started to move up a curve, parties would start to say, oh, I can see we're committed, but, and with the long series of buts that you mentioned in negating, as long as it doesn't take too much time, as long as it doesn't cost too much, as long as volunteers are doing it. As we moved up the curve further, parties would start to feel Baptist Health is a green organization that benefits from, and you would start to see a list of those benefits, and then all the way when you get up to starting being perceived as a green leader. And importantly, we mapped the initiatives that we pursued in order to fit with the curve. So where we were helped dictate what initiatives we pursued, and then also help reinforce us for social change, and I'll be moving through that as we talk about our success stories. So in an early part, the first thing we focused on was connecting to a healthcare mission. This was an early campaign. It was healthy people depend on a healthy environment, so that you didn't wind up speaking to nurses and they would say, that's nice, but I work in healthcare. Or sure. So it wasn't a nice thing to do that was on top of a business, but it was a core reality of what it meant to be a community healthcare organization. Essentially, that it's not enough to take parties inside one of our locations, provide a healthcare service, hopefully a cure, if not at least an amelioration, put them out in the environment, polluted, and make them sick again. That's more of a tobacco business model than it would be for healthcare. So when you have, if we could stay with that, so when you have a number of busy employees, having them realize how this is central to everything that they do and important for the company can be an important first step and help open the doorway for a lot of new initiatives. At the same time that we were doing that, we started to look at initiatives that could be done with a small group. So rather than trying to corral all 15,000 in one way, you could take a small group of parties. This is just an easy example. One initiative we ran with our PC monitor settings. Everyone here in the room can do that either on their own PC when they leave or with your IT today. Simple Microsoft and other settings enable that. What we did here is we powered down PC monitors after 30 minutes of inactivity. It was roughly about a $1.5 to $2 million kilowatts annual savings, about $150,000 to $175,000 in annual savings, and importantly, we started to show the benefits on an environmental, a financial, and a health perspective so that for multiple constituencies within Baptist Health, whether they said, well, my purpose is healthcare, you could talk about the health benefits. If they were in the finance department, you could talk about the finance benefits. If they were already on board and cared about the green benefits, then you could talk about carbon equivalent emissions, but specifically mentioning in a way that would speak to each constituency. So we had multiple facets. That was training, negotiations with vendors, schedules, equipment changes. So it's very comprehensive, involves many more parties than something like just changing IT equipment would. In this case, we roughly doubled recycling activity over the last 2 years. We're currently recycling a little over 200 tons of materials per month. We believe that's one of the largest numbers in South Florida. And we've roughly reduced our regulated medical waste by about 50%. So again, this would have been very difficult to do as a first initiative. We had many initiatives like the PC monitors that we showed to start building buy-in for this. And then as we moved along, started to work on more complex things.
Before you continue, Eric, how many years did it take you to get to that level? I think a lot of people will see that and say, wow, I would love if my company were able to do something like that. But I'm imagining that took a long time.
For us, it was about 2.5 years. If you talk healthcare in general, we're seeing numbers of roughly about 7, so about 5 to 10. I think we benefited a lot. It was brought up in the prior comments that South Florida, or Florida in general, has not been the most environmentally conscious area. I think that's been changing over the last couple of years. So I think we hit a point in time where there was a lot more buy-in for this type of thing than there would have been years before, where we spoke to large systems across the country in other areas. It took them longer times. They were starting earlier. A recent one was changes in our green dining environment. Specifically highlighted here was a change to remove about 11 million polystyrene foam items per year, converted those to biodegradable items. The cups were changed to ones made from recycled paper content, the plates, bowls, and others from sugar or corn bagasse materials. That's a roughly cost of about almost $500,000 for us a year. So this is something that an organization will do because they feel it's right for the environment or right for their employees, patients, staff, et cetera. Again, very difficult to do as a first initiative because you'll be running into pushback from your finance and other departments. Much easier to start with ones that show success right away and then build on that to tackle things like this. We're now in the process of launching, so the cups themselves can be recycled. We work with waste management to change their protocols, and those are now accepted. We're just in the process of launching our first composting initiative, so we'll actually be taking what were 11 million polystyrene items, which would never decompose, and now completely eliminating them from the waste stream. And the compost itself will be used on our grounds or donated to the local farm bureaus.
2 minutes.
I'll be quick. For green construction, as of 2 years ago, we had zero lead APs on staff. We now have over 20. We've launched one of the first medical plazas was in BMP Davie, was certified LEED Silver. And in April of this year, we launched West Kendall Baptist Hospital. It's a $200-plus million construction effort over the last about 5 to 7 years. It's the first new hospital in South Florida in 40 years, and it's one of only 8 LEED Gold facilities in the country. Again, something very difficult to do as one of your first initiatives, but as you start to build buy-in, much more accepted. We're now taking all of our success in what has been in more administrative and back office areas and starting to push further into the clinical areas. Operating rooms typically generate about 20 to 30% of total waste from a hospital. We now have our doctors on board and others, and we're really reevaluating how we do everything in the clinical environment and launching a number of initiatives there. For those either from the Northeast or who remember back in the mid-90s, there was a seminal event when hospital waste washed up on the Jersey Shore. For those who remember, and a number of regulations were passed quickly on that, and a lot of changes were made to operating room environments in order to prevent for that, and what you're now seeing in the industry in general is sort of a reevaluation of that and making sure that that really is best and starting to change practices back to essentially the way things were done almost 20 years ago, just pulling back certain areas because we found that there actually weren't health benefits, but they were greatly increasing costs and the amount of waste being generated. The last part, as you start to move up the adoption curve, we feel that sharing and recognition is a great part of the normalization that was talked about. So getting out in the community, trumpeting things you're doing with less negation on it, and hopefully inviting others to share in their success. We do publish stats on things that we do and also brochures and training materials, and we try and help other parties to do the same initiatives for the benefits as well. And with that, I'll just...
You're right on time.
Other things and questions. Thank you.
You're right on time. Eric, thank you. Rules are, if you have a question, state your name and your organization, and then fire away. We'd like to get a couple in, maybe two or three, and then we'd let John speak, and then we'll dive back in, and we'll open it up for as many questions as you all have. Question in the back.
Michael Fishback, Great Well Conservancy, not a journalist.
Thank you, Michael.
So you mentioned, first of all, bravo.
Thank you.
Bravo. But the bravo is with your organization, and since you are gaining expertise in your organization with all the things that you're doing, you mentioned something about getting out into the community and thinking about what you do. How about direct? Do you directly go with your experience and your expertise to other large companies in South Florida and try to teach them about why this is the way to go? Because to me, if you're not doing that, semi-bravo.
Okay. We'll take that. So there's a couple of things there. So one of the biggest things that we are working on is there's a group called Practice Green Health, and there's Healthcare Without Harm, and there's a couple of groups across the country. But specifically Practice Green Health, and if you go look at the Clean Med conference from April this year. You can actually download my presentations from there. So about 600 leading hospitals from across the country are getting together. We have monthly conference calls. We share stats and we look at, so our training materials will be offered for free to other hospitals across the country who will want to do the same things. When we do analysis on a recent initiative has been with LED lighting. So when we do an analysis of all manufacturers, our RFP materials, our financial analysis for how they can benefit, our engineers' analysis on lighting, et cetera, we'll pass that to other parties. So specifically in healthcare, there's a national sharing group that is very powerful and helps with a lot of the main steps that are very hard for organizations to do, your background research, but it essentially can be the same for a lot of parties. So organizing that and sharing that can help a lot of parties move up the curve much quicker.
That sounded like a very interesting question, Michael, if I might. Yalmaz, did you want to comment on that one as well?
Sure. So the way we articulate our environmental approach is to increasingly buy green, be green, and sell green. And so sell green includes not only selling greener products, but educating the marketplace as much as we can. So we've got a seminar series called Small Steps to a Greener Workplace, where we've hit 20 cities around the country, and we engage customers, potential customers, the local community, and it's really an educational series rather than a product selling series. It's what is, you know, climate change? What is what are the economics of environmentally preferable choices, and helping, you know, people understand the green savings continuum and things like that.
Just one little follow up. But to me, it's like essential that this is done to other large businesses, not so much to the public. I mean, you guys, or in particular, Eric, well, both of you, having success in greening up your operations. It, you know, this is a planetary issue here, and if you're good at it, seems to me that you've got to go directly to the other large businesses, not just other healthcare things, neighbors in your community, in your town. Teach them what you know so everybody's good.
So I started off with just mentioning about healthcare. So that's more on a national scale. From a local, there's a couple of organizations which are trying to help facilitate that. The Chamber has taken a leading role in South Florida. Actually, the Sustainable South Florida Awards are taking place mid-November. I believe it's the 17th, and actually Jeff Burnside will be hosting the event.
It's like everything else.
Yes. You are seeing more publications in Miami Today, South Florida Business Journal, others who are highlighting initiatives like this. When we launched the West Kendall Baptist Hospital LEED Gold certification, we had added what we believe is the first electric vehicle charging station on a hospital campus in the country. FPL unveiled their new fleet car with us on the site at the same thing. So there's a lot of sharing going on, particularly between parties. I believe it can be more organized than it is, but it is starting to happen.
Well, before we get one question in, I just wanted to introduce John Turchin. He hasn't had a chance to make his presentation yet, but I know there's a question here, but I also wanted to make sure that you had a chance to sort of get a swing at Michael's question.
Well, you know, it's a complete awareness of, as you said, you know, whatever knowledge you have, how do you expand it? So many more people know. I'm a developer. Been doing unique things. I mean, I told Kevin the other day when we were talking, I was green before green was green. I mean, it's always just a conscious level of how I always was thinking. Been a developer, and you go to an island, and there's nothing there, no resources, and you take whatever's there, and you try to make it self-sufficient from what's there. And that mentality comes from, you know, has gone on in my life. I built my home in Miami here 11 years ago, designed it all local materials. I thought about where everything was coming from, used solid concrete because it was a local product, built a complete cistern in it. We were in a drought at that time, put a cistern in that held 60,000 gallons of water, collected every bit of it, used my air conditioning and a desal plant, pulled water out of the bay, made my own water. And when I sold the house, it was a negative that the cistern was in this house, and how could you put something in this thing? And I'm like, this is the future. You mean, you know, collecting rain, water without, you know, taxing it, and they wanted the cistern taken out of the house. But if you go back in time and history, you know, every house collected rainwater. That's where they got it from. They weren't relying on drilling a well. They collected rainwater. But it's, you know, what is green? How do you educate the people today? How do you get them aware of it subtly to do the right thing? I own a mountain in North Carolina, 1,500 acres, and part of my whole program, I'm marketing to Generation X and aware of what's going on today. And I started with, where's, you know, how do I make the place self-sufficient? And I was doing it for my own purpose. Everybody was threatening 2012 was coming and our world was going to come to an end. I said, well, maybe it really would happen. I'll build a marina at 3,500 feet up in the mountains. But I have 1,500 acres, and I took and I started pursuing where's my water, where's my power, where's my food come from. I had an old farm. I went back to NC State and redeveloping the farm there. Where's all our food come from? What will grow up in the mountains? Water comes from, you know, natural water there. You drill a well, you got a spring, and you bottle water there. Power. I got into the solar world. Where do I get my power from? I started to investigate wind, solar. How could I power my complete community? As a result of this, trying to make my own community and then marketing it, you know, to the public, it's self-sufficient. It just felt good, you know. Trying to sell a solar system on somebody's home, all they care about is it going to cost me any more money. They don't want to do it. Anything you put in, I've found such resistance in adding green, you know, features and LED lead sort of. Is it going to cost me more money? So what I did is said, let me build a solar system that'll power the complete community and give it to the community. Many communities, when they're doing their land planning, they say, well, they're set aside by the zoning regulations and the government regulations to have much green space. Well, I believe anytime anybody gets a permit today, there should be something should be set aside for where's your power come from. Just like the park, just like everybody else, where's your power? It's so easy today and predictable. The sun comes up every day. You know, we know how many hours it's going to come up. And across the world, the sun stops coming up, we're all screwed anyway. So, you know, I think, you know, and I started talking to other developers, and many developers, all they do is sell solar systems on the roofs included in the cost of the home. And if it costs any more money, the people don't want it. And I have found, build a solar system for the incomplete community, add it as an amenity, give it to the homeowners. The subsidies from the government and the state right now will pay for the entire thing. The developer could be a hero. Give it to the complete community as an amenity, and they wouldn't have any POA dues. And they might get a check from the power they're, you know, developing in their community, you know. And, I mean, you know, so it's really an awareness. I've started this with my own personal, you know, for myself. As a result of it, I got into the solar business, and I'm all over. And I call people every day. I know every CEO, everybody owns a business across this country, and I can get them on the phone and say, you want to make some money from your roof? And they're all ears. Give me more information. And right now, it's really about giving more information and making it accessible, as you said, and easy for them. How do I do it? What's it going to cost me? How do I do it? How do I touch this? How do I become part of it? I've had such response from everybody I know across the country that's, you know, that has real estate, that has a business, whatever, and they want more information. And the key is today is how do you do it? And that's what's driven me into the solar business. And, you know, every day we get on the phone, we talk to people, and they want more information. How do I do it? And that's the real key today, is taking our knowledge and expanding it to the public, making it easy.
This is Pollutions and Solutions, Untold Environmental Success Stories in Industry and Government. I'm Kevin Corp. We hope you've enjoyed our panelists. This is my favorite time of the day. This gives us all now a chance to sort of play firing squad here and see what they've got. We have been listening to John Turchin, Eric Winke, and Yanma Siddiqui. Today, for me, is a chance to really dig and drill down on what can we do, not just as journalists, I'm a journalist, but what can we do as industry, what can we do as government to not only tell this story, to rebrand the way people see it, but also to expand the knowledge base, because ultimately I believe knowledge is power, and that will make people, as you just pointed out, John, very well, more interested, whether it's saving them money, helping the environment, doing something good. Light green, I think, really works. If you have a question this morning, we ask that you say your name and your organization, and then have your question answered, and you do get a follow-up. Go right ahead.
Thank you. Don Mears, Office Depot Communications and Public Relations, colleague of Yama. Eric, your presentation interests me particularly because
thank you.
When I go into an operating room as a patient, It doesn't interest me to know that you're green and saving the environment out there. I want to know you're going to save me. And I want to know that you're not compromising my care by going green. How have you got that message out to your customers?
Well, I think at this point, these are newer initiatives on that area, and it hasn't necessarily gone to, if you define customers as patients, I mean, we don't have a typical customer. But the customer right now for these initiatives are the doctors and nurses, so the parties working in that environment. And in many cases, it's actually not a detriment. So if they have a paper type garment or a light plastic, we're able to contract for a Gore-Tex type garment that's much heavier material, the same way that was mentioned here. A better product that can be reusable and not necessarily one that is disposable. They will bring them in. We'll have them try that on. We'll replicate an environment. We'll turn all the lights on. It gets very hot in there. They'll have a much freer, easier breathing thing. OR formulation kits today have been standardized to the point that you wind up opening up, if you've seen where they open up the blue wrap and then you have these large pack kits, about this much gets used. And what happens is this surgeon prefers these tools and this surgeon prefers these tools and this surgeon prefers these tools. But in order to standardize, everything gets put in. And then you wind up wasting a large percentage of that. We're working on ways to reformulate the kits so that they're specific just-in-time type inventory where you're creating packs very specific to that one surgeon. Will not affect the patient at all, but will greatly affect the amount of waste generated from any procedure. Blue wrap is a disposable wrap that's used around to unpack devices and to make sure they're sterilized when they come in. We're replacing that with hard shell containers. So again, not to dispose of that. The recyclers can't take that level of plastic. And again, it won't affect the patient. And in fact, it's better for everyone overall.
Next question, Jeff in the back.
So John is very humble about his development. I've been there, and it is a spectacular endeavor for someone who's the D word, you know. Really, here's a guy who, you know, shatters the mold, at least the stereotype of the developer. Do you have pictures, by the way, John, of your...
Yeah, but
we have
the... Or you just type in the website.
Yeah, we should do that.
Well, he appreciate this mountain development that he's done.
It's called Eagle's Nest BE for Banner Elk.
Can you type it in?
Yeah, it's really spectacular.
And while he's queuing that up, John,
I think that's
you and I have had this conversation before, but what are the impediments that local and state governments do to prevent developers with good intentions or bad intentions?
Well, what I've seen recently, every city, everybody wants to be part of it right now. They don't know how to get it. I guess we just put out Johnson City, Tennessee, just put out an RFP to take 38 of their public buildings and turn it over to a solar company to get free power. And they're giving us all of their rooftops and things. So they don't know how to get into it, and they're trying to figure out. So they put a bid out, and 11 solar companies came in, and, you know, we have to make a financial investment, put it on their buildings, give them free power and a percentage of what we're making. But the key to this is, once you put it in, it works for 40 years. No moving parts, the sun comes up, minimal maintenance. We're not putting it, you know, we've looked at wind, there's a lot of things going on with it, a lot of moving parts, it's variable. Wind, it's unpredictable when to when it's going to blow and how much it blows. Sun is very predictable. And if you start putting tracking devices in, well, now you got moving parts and someone to maintain it and something to break. We have found a stagnant solar panel. I mean, I've had it on my home here in Miami since the 30s, and it's made my hot water forever. You know, it's nothing new. The sun comes up. It's predictable. But the real thing is, they don't know how to go about doing it. I work with App State University, Appalachian State University in North Carolina. They have one of the best tech departments in the country. They should be a leader in their whole campus, and they're not. They got a small budget of $200,000 a year to put it in, rebuilding the whole campus. Why isn't that department leading the complete redevelopment of the campus and guiding every bit of it? You know, it feels good, and they're like, why aren't they have the best department? Why don't they have them be part of the design of every one of these buildings? And
and go on and on.
I mean, John, do you not find that isn't the primary barrier the economic dimension of solar, at least, which is the significant upfront cost with very long-term accrual of benefits? Unless there's a unique financing model, that's what I see as the main barrier.
That's what you think. Right now, there's government incentives. The federal government will pay you 30% cash rebate back. Mm-hmm. Difference. It's a shell game. The problem is there's no uniform energy policy across the country mandating the utility companies to pay a certain amount for power across the board. It's a shell game. It moves around the country, moves around the state, it moves around, and you have to watch every day. Like FPL, who are the biggest players in this industry right now? FPL? Duke Power, okay, and they don't want us really in their business, okay? So they dribble out little drops and make it feel good to the public. We're going to put out $15 million worth of incentives, and it's gone in 3 hours, and they're eaten up. But how do you find them? It's just not there. It's not open to the public. It's not. You know, I talk to many people, and the first thing, they send it to their bean counters. Oh, it's unaffordable. It's this, it's that. They want to find every reason why not to do it. We find every reason to do it and put it on. Let us show you the numbers of this thing. We have an accounting firm up in Boston that's proving the numbers and the rebates and how this whole thing works, because they don't believe us.
Yeah.
So, you know, everybody wants it. They're afraid to do it. But, you know, how do you take the first step? We had a fellow the other day signed a contract yesterday, and we were trying to put a 1 megawatt system on his building, and he said, no, I don't want to do it. You know, all his bean counters came, so we put a 50 kilowatt system, a teensy little system. And he signed the contract yesterday, and he says, I want a bigger system. I said, well, your bean counter shot down, but we finally got him to do it. And the big thing is the initial check, to write that check. You know, it's a short term. What you really need is the bridge money to do it, about a year, and you get your rebates back and all, and then you own this system, and you get a check every month for guarantee. You know, it depends what your contract is with the power company, but after the contract is up, they're dependent on using that power. They've subsidized it, and they no longer need to build another nuclear plant or a coal plant, and they got used to the power, and it will continue on for 40 years. It's an annuity forever.
Let me open the floor to more questions. Your name and your organization, and then your question, please.
Hi, I'm Lily Best, and I'm the U.S. Wildlife Service. My question, I have several questions for you, Jonathan. Do you operate only in Florida? Do you sell these systems, or are you just, you sell the systems? And then what do you provide these folks that come in, a couple of people, you convince them, do you give them a package?
Well, it starts with, first of all, I want to own as many of these systems as I can. I want to own them myself. Okay, I want to own a utility company. So I'm owning a utility company. That's how I look at it. And I say to anybody that owns a building, would you like to own your own little utility company? You got a roof, you got a farm, you know, what is it that you own, land? And I start with it that way. It's, you know, the information on it is very simple. The other day we did a demonstration. We put it up in one day, a $50,000 system, just to show somebody what it was, because we have a whole board at a home called Grandfather Home up in the mountains there, and 38 members of the board didn't understand what it is. And other people were bringing in a brochure, and they were bringing in a panel. Well, we went in and put a whole system in one day, and so they could see it, feel it, touch it. And out of as a result of it, we had 38 board members all scratching their head and went away and said, I could put this in my own business and my own property. They started to understand it. So, you know, again, it's getting everybody to understand. It's not this terrible thing. You know, I look at it, it's a farm. We grow vegetables. We grow Christmas trees. We grow all types of things in farms. Why not grow power farms? You know, so when you put it in the terms, it's a utility, it's a farm. And you're raising energy from the sun, and I have a roof I can put it on. I already have the infrastructure there. I'll put a new roof on my building while I'm doing it. You know, everybody wants to find out the reason why not to do it and not to look at the positives.
Yeah, it sounds like you're also benefiting from some of that psychology of the consumer, where it's the same thing when you give a sample, you know?
Yes. Anywhere in the country.
I mean, I'm partners with a fellow out of South Florida here, and how I found him, I wanted to do it in North Carolina. I started investigating who could do it, and I went to a few solar shows, and I found out how really easy it was, you know, based on what I'm used to doing, buying a piece of land, developing it, planning it, all the steps, 10 years later to go by. This is the easiest thing I've ever done in my life. It's so easy. And, you know, I get my money back in a year, and I'm making a check for the rest of my life. So you take any smart business person and say, make this investment, you know, and you get your money back in a period of time, and then you have a check coming in for, you know, the lifetime of the system.
Remind me to give you my card. Anyway, more questions from the floor. More questions from the floor.
I'm sorry to ask John again. So if I understand, then when you put in the solar array as a gift, as you call it, to the community, then the individual home buyers didn't really have a choice, because if they're looking to cut costs, they're going to say, no, I don't want that. But if it's one system for the whole community, it makes the no more difficult, I guess, right?
Well, I've been talking to developers. Everybody knows a developer, and I've been saying, why don't you put a system in instead of a park and give it to the POA as a gift? You get it all back in rebates from the state and the government. You give it to them, and now you basically can promote, you know, living in the community with no POA fees.
What's a POA?
HOA.
HOA fees, yeah. Excuse me.
Homeowners Association.
Yeah, your homeowner, you know, most communities all have, you have to pay fees to live in it, you know, and for the common areas and things, unless you're in a community that's, and then you're paying taxes to the state, to the city you're in. The cities should be doing this.
I wanted to ask a question. Yalmaz, I want you to sort of expand on something you talked about earlier. Incrementalization leads to normalization.
Yeah.
Unpack that for me just a bit, because I think sometimes, when I'm writing a story, we tend to go broad, we tend to go big, but sometimes it's the little things that companies are doing, individuals are doing, that can sort of make it seem like that's not such a big leap after a while.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I want to go back to the analogy that in America, there's a perception that green equals transformation in my life or my company, because historically, in America at least, it's been a small segment of dark greenies to use a lack of an available word for this community has defined the agenda. So you've got to live the Berkeley life almost. And I would argue that many people, mainstream America, doesn't accept that and doesn't want to transition their lives or their businesses to go completely green. And so if you introduce projects or initiatives that deliver quick wins that are small and can be celebrated as a small win within your organization, other people then look at that and say, oh, that's interesting. They're doing this green stuff. It's not as onerous as, or at least they're saying it's not as onerous as they thought, and they're getting benefits from it. Someone else in a different function hears that, knows about it, sees someone's being celebrated, says, okay, let me try a little bit and do this one thing in the area I control. And so it becomes a cascade, a positive cycle upwards, rather than an internal perception that this stuff is not business.
Right. Eric, I saw you nodding.
Well, I think it maps very well with the organizational, you know, design theory we have been talking about. And again, also the role of media, you know, in portraying. So when you look at large groups and change behavior, where it's been studied in both humans and in animals, so where you take out the degree of human psychology out of it, it's been found that large changes begin to be adopted by the group with a certain subset once they've done that. And it's not, so if we had a group of 100, it's not one person, it's not two people. That's where you get they're hippies, they're the dark green. So where that small group becomes ostracized by the norm. You use an important word, normalization. You would think that you would have to get up towards 51, 55, you know, where you get over half for the rest to adopt, and it's actually not. The numbers are more like 10, 12. So it's actually, once you have a core group that is demonstrating success, that is being celebrated, the parties who are in the larger set will look over and say, that looks very interesting what they're doing. I'd like to be a part of that. And more will come. And that's what we had mapped out what we call the green adoption curve. It winds up looking like an S-curve. So it takes off slowly in the beginning, and that's where your incremental successes can really help you move up. And then once you get to what we call the pragmatists, which is your large majority, they have, if you've read, you're bringing up books, but like the tipping point, once you get over that, the large majority tends to follow. So we all know people, and this happens in different areas. We all know the party who the new iPhone comes out and they're camping out outside. They're your early adopter. And different people have different things that they are for. So someone, it's a new pair of shoes. Someone's a different fashion item. Someone's at Home Depot looking at tools. You know, everyone has their one thing that they're early on. So it's not just that some people are early and everybody's always late. In this area, though, what you need is to wrap around that early group and not necessarily negate what they're doing, an important word you would use as well. So to the degree that we make fun or poke holes or take away from what's being done, that is a message to the large majority that it's okay to stay over here. You do not need to change, because what they're doing is actually not something that you want to go along with. To the degree that we work to help make these small changes and celebrate what's going on, that's a message to the large majority to say, maybe it would help if we moved over a little bit over there.
Can I add one nuance? From a journalistic standpoint, if we're trying to celebrate that small story and it's demonized as not significant and not transformative as you know could take place in that company, then the champion who's done that internally doesn't want to do any more.
Yeah. Well, you have to keep advancing what you're doing, taking to the next level. I've always been a leader out in front, taking tremendous risk and doing it because I want to. I've never been a follower. So what's next? You know, I mean, right now I see tremendous resistance, you know, of people if it costs more money. You know, like you said, what shade of green are you? You know, everybody wants to be a little bit, you know, is it the right word even to call it green, or is it the right thing to be part of the, you know, I mean, you know, do we change the word and take the word green out of it completely and just say this is right and for the economy, I mean, not the environment, for myself, for my life,
right.
You know, instead of branding it, what level green are you? This is what we need to do for the environment to save our resources so our children, you know, can live in this world.
We've found that often cost goes up and down as a requirement. If you follow socionomics, I mean, certain parties will even map it to stock market movements. But essentially, over the last couple of years, where we've had large variations in people's perceptions about how the future economy will be, the importance of cost goes up or down in the conversation. Mm-hmm. And what we've tried to do is there are so many great things that you can do for low or no cost. So at the point where cost becomes a big impediment, just stop, regroup, and focus on conservation initiatives that can have immediate savings so that you're not pushing up against a wall, but you're constantly making progress. And then as cost comes down as the determining factor, because people's perceptions about the future get to be a brighter green, then go back to those. And so rather than just picking one initiative and always fighting that one fight, having a broad basket of things to go to and sort of following where the crowd is going and keep moving forward.
I have a couple questions on the floor. Let's go to the back. Your name, your organization, and your question.
Jessica Marshall, freelance. My question is sort of related to this. What are some things maybe that are not at this point cost effective, but that you're sort of looking ahead, you know, as you know, fuel prices continue to rise or you know, a few years down the line that you think are going to become important ways to tackle?
What's the next big story?
Some of them, they might not be as a sexy story, but there's ones that actually just really happened in about the last year, and we're seeing a big sea change, and that's in lighting. About 40% of a building's energy costs can come from things like, you know, your standing fixtures and plug loads and lighting, etc. We were piloting a number of smaller LED lighting tests. For those who are not familiar, you usually have your fluorescent tubes, T8s, T5s, T12s were an older technology. It was essentially the width when someone comes in and changes the light in your ceiling and they pull out that big tube. So our lead gold hospital, which was launched in April, where they were mapping out the lighting for that facility essentially just about a year and a half, 2 years ago, was done with T5s, so the most advanced fluorescent lighting available at the time. We're now, when we're looking at end-of-life cycle units across our facilities, we're now running large pilots to replace them with LED lighting. Removes mercury to the end user. When LED lighting degrades, there's no flicker. So you remove headache, buzzing, other type issues. We found that versus the T8s, which they're typically replacing, because the T5s tend to be newer in our facilities, the manufacturers are suggesting about a 40% energy savings. When we've hooked devices up to the circuits, we're finding over 50, which is a large change. The prices on the units have come down by roughly 40% just in the last year. So these are curves that are moving very quickly, and about a year ago, it would have been difficult to justify because you would have had a much longer time to break even. Today, you're finding, and the same thing is happening with solar, with wind, with other.
Solar panels dropped 30% this year.
We got 4 minutes to go. Did you want to follow up on that?
Yeah, could I just respond by asking you to look at this chart? This is the McKinsey curve on what things you can do to save money and reduce carbon. And you'll see commercial electronics. That means servers and data centers that are much more efficient, and the cloud as ways to dramatically save money and reduce carbon. I don't think that's been talked about enough. I'd say there's fuel economy packages like trucks. I'd say rather than just hybrids or electrics, lightweighting of vehicles might be a big thing in the transportation space, because often you're just dragging weight around when you don't need to. And I would agree with the LED is a big breakthrough, because, frankly, the biggest economic opportunity, I would say, is in lighting, and really ramping up retrofitting lighting in the country.
Question. I know you have a question, as does Lori. Any other questions from this side? We'll go back to the folks. I think you had your hand up first.
I wanted to pick up on Ronnie, who I didn't
introduce. No,
on an expression I think John used, talking about the feel-good factor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which I think is very important, but it's also important to recognize the feel-good factor for business is not the same thing as the feel-good factor for an individual or a person. Sure. There may be overlap between the two, but they're not the same. Yamas, I think you probably have some comments on that from what I know you've talked about in the Office Depot context of marketing green.
Internally.
Internally, externally. What's the business feel-good factor?
I'd say the business feel-good factor for individuals is differentiating themselves in their career because they've done something good for their business. That's I really believe people are in their small silos in their own worlds in companies. I'd say I've been effective and able to move functional areas when I'm enabling them to tell their stories and look good within this kind of unusual internal political dynamic that is the organization. So I'd say there's a feel good that I've done something that helps, you know, save money or makes us look good, or it's an innovation. So innovation is a big aspect of feel good.
So that's personal feel good in the business context.
Yeah, that's... And then being celebrated.
I've found, because I'm knocking on CEOs all over the country, they, you know, have buildings all over and land, and you know, does it feel good? And you know, if I can get them to understand, it makes them feel good, and then they see it everywhere. They don't know how to get the knowledge, and you know, and all they hear is, you know, a few years ago it was negative, you know, everything, and there's been failures in it. You know, it was just now a major failure. You know, the government gave one company $500 million and failed. The government should have given 100 companies $5 million, and 70% of them would have succeeded. You know? This is our government for you. But, you know, it's an awareness. And how do we get these people to feel good? How do we get them to do it? You know?
I think the answer is different for different groups of parties, which is one of the reasons why we tend to talk about green benefits along a number of different dimensions. So specifically on the slide before, we had shown environmental, financial, and health. We take carbon dioxide equivalent reductions and translate them using EPA calculators to avoided bronchitis, avoided emergency room visits. So for parties who in a healthcare organization are most concerned about health and not as much about how much waste is avoided or financial benefits, we have a message for you. This initiative that you did helped avoid 5 ER visits. Some parties will tend to say, oh, that green part was nice that you put it in the newsletter, but what I really liked is that we saved $250,000 or $1 million or $10 million or whatever from it. We're saying the negation of HOA or others. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's great that I'm doing something for the environment, but what I really like is how my pocket feels after the decision. And then other parties really conglomerate around just the green benefits themselves. So whether it cost money, saved money, whether it was good for others, I just, you know, this is something I've believed in all my life or others. So it's important to have multiple ways of speaking about it, depending on the audience. This afternoon, I'm actually leaving here, straight from here, we have our annual recycled art contest. There is actually probably zero waste eliminated from this event. So it's not necessarily one that we're going to put up a slide and show you the big environmental benefits of. But we have about 50 entries from across the system today where parties are taking items that would normally be disposed of as waste and creating art. And I actually have to tell you that some of them are absolutely beautiful. I don't even enter. West Kendall Baptist Hospital. I don't even enter because I couldn't. But that is some way for parties to participate. So ones who may not have been able to, you know, feel other benefits or contribute in some ways. And it keeps the conversation going, highlights success. So really mapping how you talk about it to the audience.
Gentlemen, I really appreciate it. We are short of time, Lori. I don't want to leave you out. We have about 2 minutes, if you have, maybe 3 minutes tops. If you have one more question you'd like to
get. It's a quick question. It's probably not a quick answer, but right now, you talked about some of the subsidies and some of the payments, especially for the solar the government provides. I know they're not perfect, but right now they're talking about getting rid of them. So what kind of impact do you think that'll have?
20 seconds each, guys.
It's a big impact. I mean, we're signing contracts right now before the end of the year all over, and there's an urgency. The government hopefully will continue to subsidize it, because without it right now, the numbers don't work. So we need to continue to subsidies until it's the right thing to do, and everybody across this country says it's part of my building process. Just like a roof, we should be putting some type of renewable energy system on our property.
I would say today, if you're speaking specifically about solar or certain parts, it will have a big impact. It will cut down on the incrementalism. You'll hear less about projects going forward. You'll be less inclined to do it yourself. If you talk about the green movement overall, I think it'll have a smaller impact. Parties will redirect their efforts and work on other areas that may not have as much cost or that'll have more immediate paybacks.
Yeah, so I would add to that and supplement it by saying there's a wide range of projects you can implement with 1 year or less payback or 2 year or less payback that companies are not sometimes doing because they're trying to do other things, bigger things, when the boring stuff is actually where a lot of the savings are, and that's not necessarily going to go away.
Okay, we have exactly 2.5 minutes. What I'd like to do is I like Hardball with Chris Matthews. He's as this thing at the end of the show, he goes, let me finish. This is closing thought. This will be tough because these folks have so much that you've shared already today, but I'd like to give you each 1 minute. What's the one point you want to make sure? If you leave here and you remember nothing else today, please remember this. You've got 1 minute to make one point. We'll start on the end.
I'm going
to
make 3 points in a minute. So, as journalists, I would recommend and like writing less of this and more of this. So, less company X didn't do this and is bad, okay? And more company Y did this and saved or made money. Less of company X is greenwashing, and more company Y is helping define what green is. That's a lot harder to define what green is than to, you know, say you're greenwashing. And then thirdly, less of activist or environmental group Z accuses company of that, and more of environmental group Z lauded company Y for doing this. It's a real transition from negative to positive, and I would argue that it'll help you achieve your goals as journalists who want to drive change in the country, and it will certainly help us as internal champions who are actively trying to move our large ships in a slightly greener direction.
Eric?
We're in a seminal moment in time right now. We've never had as much cultural acceptance of these types of changes from the population at large. We've never had as much technology and different ways to impact change. some with low cost, some with more cost, but you have a great lining up of people who are willing and tools for enablement. So please help us take advantage of it. Thank you.
I would say just keep the awareness going and to send a message out, you know, that really the awareness of everything you're doing, the environment, what's it lead to, what products we're using, who's doing the right thing, and support those that are doing the right thing.
I want to thank all of you gentlemen for a stimulating conversation, for being champions both internally within your companies and organizations and individually, but also being champions of our world, our country, and indeed we need more people like you. My name is Kevin Cork. I didn't provide an email. If you'd like to write me, if you have questions or follow up, or most importantly, if you have story ideas that you'd like to see make it on air and Jeff Burnside's too busy to do them, send them my way. My email address is kevin.cork@nbc.com. I would like to encourage you all to head downstairs. Lunch will be served here very shortly. In the meantime, thank you and enjoy the remainder of the conference.
Pleasure meeting you. Good luck with the development. Thank you. Great.